Let me finish my cheese and biscuits and then we'll get on.
We've already started recording, Justin. This is all going straight in.
Let me finish my cheese and biscuits is absolutely going to be in the intro now.
I think the listeners would appreciate if we edit out the mouth noises though. Crunching on Jacob's crackers and mature cheddar, lips touching the mic.
I thought you got some like charcuterie for like some food pairing bit later, but you're just gonna eat a big wadge of cheese in front of it.
Is that not a food pairing? I have finished the second of my cheese biscuits.
So what? All right, yeah.
I will not have the third and fourth on air.
This is all being great content.
So let's go. We'll cut this down by at least 10%. Anyway, cue intro music. Hello and welcome everybody to our latest episode of Cider Voice or Cider Voice or Cider Voice or any other sort of prosodic pitch variation and tonic stress you would like to apply to it. I am joined as always by my co-hosts Albert Johnson and Adam Wells. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing sensational.
Sensational.
Yeah, that's much like Cider Voice.
when Justin was doing that, obviously I did it last episode. I was thinking that actually nobody but us finds that funny, as far as I'm aware.
I think nobody but us finds vast chunks of our content funny, to be honest.
But so long as we can be baffling in a compelling way. Had a nice evening.
Yeah.
Good cricket news.
Truly enjoyed the cricket today. And have then been finishing off the exclusive artisanal range of 500ml bottles. And I say artisanal not because of the way they were made, but because of the way that they shall be covered with some really nice labels. In when they come out, and I've been finishing them with my brother this evening, so I'm primed.
Oh, that sounds great. It is a rather unfortunate implication that you're like, these aren't artisanal cider because of what's in them, it's because of the bottles. The juice, dog shit, terrible, terrible.
Well, this is very much the nature of the beast. nobody cares what's in the bottle, they just care about what it looks like.
Well, Adam has strong feelings about bottles and punts and lettering on the label. But there we go. Punt. Adam, how are you?
I'm very well. I don't know that I have that strong feeling. I just, we had a... I don't know.
You have opinions on the punt awesomeness and the depth of the punt.
No, so this was a kind of running joke when I worked in the wine industry that you get a lot of people who make very, very, often very, very nice and, but usually very, very expensive wine and very, very heavy bottles that have an incredibly deep punt. Those who aren't aware, the punt is a little indentation in the bottom of the bottle. We're not talking about one of those boats you sort of pole along. But yeah, we had a theory that depth of a bottle's punt was indicative of premium quality. And although that is clearly not true, it was a thing we like to say to each other.
I mean, I think that's a widely subscribed to theory though, because often the depth of one's punt directly correlates to the weight of one's bottle, which directly correlates to the price you pay for it, which for most people is genuinely their first indicator of quality. If it's from a producer you don't know, the price is what most of us will say, well, you know, if it costs a certain amount, then it's more likely to be good, isn't it? So
yeah, it's true.
The punt is what the punt is. But, at Ross and Wye, we have always erred on the side of lower carbonation, so we don't need a punt. You know, the origin of the punt, for people who don't know, is that it makes the shape stronger, so it can withstand higher pressure. Because we don't have any need for high pressure, we have both lighter weight bottles, which is better for the environment, and more affordable for us and for you. And they have smaller and smaller punts. And in fact, the bottles that we bought last year have almost no punt at all, which when they arrived, having not fully comprehended that this was going to be the case when I ordered them from France, I was marginally alarmed and I thought people might comment on it. But actually, in fact, no one has to my face ever observed it.
No, I think that's very good. I mean, as you say, you know, usually the bottles that have, you know, these massive punts, and especially when it's a still wine where like carbonation is completely irrelevant, right? You know, they are very, very heavy and, you know, glass is the biggest contributor to the carbon emissions of the wine and cider industries in the world. And we should mention that there are some wine people like Tamlin, who came on our Bittersweets panel for GraphCon, who have done a lot of work to start highlighting that from their platforms by publishing like the weight of glass bottles. And a lot of wineries have started to you know, not all wineries by any means, but a lot of wineries have started to take note that this is a thing. And so hopefully ridiculously heavy bottles with massive punts that don't need them will ultimately be a thing of the past. But it was a funny joke briefly when I was ignorant and young in my wine industry days. And that's a completely irrelevant aside. Thanks very much for it, Justin.
Hey, you're very welcome. And I am going to hold it as gospel that the depth of the punt is a measure of quality. And I will tell everyone who can listen that this was told to me by Adam Wells, Esquire.
Raison d'etre has barely any punt in 2021. Anyway, to answer your original question, I am well. What are you drinking today, Justin?
I am drinking, and we're going to find out, well, leave it to the listener to see if they can figure out exactly what the unifying factor for today's episode is. I am drinking a 500ml from Rosson Y, because I'm a filthy shill. I am drinking a single variety Ellis Bitter. From Ross. I recently joined Ross's rather lovely Cider Crew, which is a kind of subscription service. So once again, you know, please excuse us. I'm going to be chilling and marketing, as is my wont. But yeah, so joined that, signed up for the 500ml bottles because I realised I almost exclusively buy 750s. And so I decided to mix things up and get some 500s because I want to try more single varieties because I haven't tried all that many single varieties. So, it's Ellis Bitter, being a fairly infamous apple and one that has a fairly hefty rasp of tannins. Some really nice fruit in there as well. Got some good body too. It's got a super distinctive nose on it, though, which one of the reasons I chose this one is when I was... Another thing I'll never let anyone forget is that I spent some time working on it. But when we were working it, I have a distinct and horrible memory of an afternoon spent pressing some extremely late season Ellis Bitter that required some quite extensive sorting. And whilst I am proud of what was ended up coming out and of the amount that we sorted, it was a fairly grueling and kind of grim process. So Ellis Bitter is implanted on my head as being not that fun to press.
A high squelch content trailer.
High squelch, like really, that was some real like fistfuls of squelch getting hammered into the bucket and the JCB.
That is the most satisfying part of toil.
Oh yeah,
I mean it's the grossest part is the water that splashes back up on you when the wranglers have emptied too much. But the most satisfying grim part is, as you put it so poetically, fistfuls of squalch.
I mean, I've got to say, I would actually say that the worst part is when you push the bucket slightly too deep, and then your glove gets filled with the squalch water. And there is a certainly.
Why do you push? What? How do you do that?
You know, the shaky thing. You know, when you're cleaning the apples and you push them with the basket and you rub them around a bit and give them a bit of a shush.
That is interchanging the terms bucket and basket, and they're not the same thing.
Yeah. And I would also
receptacle.
I would also say that whilst I definitely got pomace down my glove by over enthusiastic pomace scraping, I never got basket squelch down the marigolds. That sounds like inexpert basket.
To be fair, Adam, Justin did a lot more work than you did.
That was exactly what I was going to say. This is a two-weeker problem. You're a one-week Johnny come lately. And
even 1 week is being generous if we're all being honest.
Really? A part week Johnny come lately.
Poor day.
Whilst Shucker. I would refute that, because I was at the coalface of promoting a product that you sell, Albert, on the fifth day of my week, the further promotion that I did on the Saturday, what I would query, Justin, is why you become less expert in the second week of your toil than you were in the first.
Because of the sheer physical toll that it takes upon one, the exhaustion, the aching muscles.
On that basis, what are you saying happens to Albert by month four? He's just sort of in there, look, vaguely sort of waving at apples, tripping over and throwing squelch into the press.
I mean, Adam, you spent quite a lot of time around Albert. I think we all know what happens to Albert at the end of month four, because have you met the man? The man is a husk.
True.
Anyway, I'll stop bullying you.
We also get daily text updates.
Sorry?
I was saying we also get daily text updates of how he is at the end of month four, so we know.
Sorry for communicating with my friends.
How dare you? Anyway, Albert, what are you drinking?
I drank a few ciders earlier this evening with my brother. Really interesting ciders that I wanted to assess and analyze and really get into. I drank a few ciders with my dad when we were celebrating the glorious victory in the cricket. And so when I was 30 minutes late to arrive to record this podcast, I dashed into the barn. I did a loop of the barn whilst I was celebrating my choice of cider. And on the completion of my loop, I picked up a bottle of the 2019 vintage of Razzie D, a.k.a. Raison d'Etre.
Usually predictable, but still a good choice.
And it is filth. I've told Becky that on numerous occasions I've actually been arrested for selling cider that is too good to be legally consumed.
And what about yourself, Adam?
Well, I am not shilling shamelessly for Ross, I'm afraid, because I knew that you intended to, and I suspected, given the nature of today's subject, that Albert would be very understandably reaching for some of his own filth. And so I thought to myself, who else makes a dry bittersweet cider? And obviously the answer was Little Pomona, but we have them too much on the show as well. And then I remembered that I had a bottle from Skibori, who are up on the on the Welsh border. So I know little of this. It just says Knighton cider. Knighton is where they're based. Pressed 2019 and dry. I think it's firstly, it's very, very tasty. It's delicious. It's got that real orangey going into a marmalade-y kind of character. And obviously it's 5 years old now, so the fruit's developed magnificently. Definitely got some lovely tannins in there that are beautifully integrated, a little bit of acidity. Dry possibly depends on your parameters. If it is dry, then it is the fruitiest dry cider that I have ever had. But maybe it is the fruitiest dry cider I've ever had. I don't have the hydrometer here. So it says dry on the label. It's not sweet by any means. But anyway, very, very tasty and a fantastic maker who I don't think we have had anything from on the show before. So cheers to Adam and Danny at Skibori.
Man's a soon-to-be officially published Perry author and doesn't have a hydrometer to hand in his study. Unbelievable.
The book, this fella reckons he's going to be selling commercial cider within 2 years. Where's the hydrometer at?
Yeah.
Well, you know, when the book sells all of its copies really, really quick because of all of the promotion that you've kindly done on this show, then I'll be able to afford a hydrometer. And then, Justin, I shall keep it in my study so it is to hand when I'm not sure about the sugar levels of any given cider at any given point.
And I think that is the sign that you have graduated to the hallowed halls of a true cider and perry writer. It's nice to welcome a cider that we haven't drunk here onto the show. You know?
I just say I can't believe that Albert has outed us as planning to create cider. On
it can get deleted in the edit.
It should do, because otherwise Caroline's going to be raging. Keep off. And not least because Justin told loads of people at CraftCon as well.
I didn't realise it was a secret.
There's two things I want to pick up. One, surely we've had a Skibori on the podcast before. Now, I feel like we must have done, but possibly not. Secondly, this might be our second mea culpa when complaining about something not being dry and actually it's just really fruity but no sugar in, because apparently the artist draw that actually at the time I complained about being too sweet and then spoke to them and they said there's absolutely no sugar in it, so I deleted all of me complaining from the recording and got published. I had no sugar in, and this may well be the same case, especially if it's 5 years old.
Yeah. I'm open to the possibility that it may I may be being deceived by the sheer fruity deliciousness of it.
Mm.
But also, did that artist draw not say that it had 3 grams per liter of residual sugar in the bottle?
Yes, I think it may well have done. Which indeed brings me on to the end of my point, which is what is dry? I mean, dry is such a catch-all term for so many things, and it means different things to different people, and we could talk about a lot of terms in this episode and in the future about what does it mean to who, and can we even put the law on it.
Well you can, and here's a really interesting point, because I am currently, and I'll something I do want to flag, I'm currently studying for the Pommelier exam, which is the one that the American Cider Association have done for many years, and they've rolled out. Sorry,
I just yelled nerd into the microphone.
Ah, well, I bet the sound quality was great. Anyway, they've rolled that globally, and I'm very lucky to be very lucky, but also very anxious to be taking it in a week and a half from when we're recording. And part of that, they have a section talking about various sort of laws and labels and so on. And some countries do indeed have legal definitions of what constitute dry. And Albert, I'm very interested to get your takes on some of these, because not all countries do. We certainly don't in the UK, but here we go. France, extra brut, so we're talking very dry, has to be less than 18 grams per litre of residual sugar. Brut, which is dry, can be a maximum of 25 grams per litre of residual sugar. Then other countries that have similar levels of what constitute dry, in Quebec, you know, you might expect there to be some similar rules to France, but there, a dry must be less than 30 grams per litre of residual sugar. Very, very stringent conditions for dryness. Or if it's still, it must be less than 25 grams per litre. And in Norway, dry means less than 20 grams per litre. So by any of those parameters, this Skibori is unquestionably dry. It is very dry, extra brut, Welsh English cider, whether or not it's at 0 grams per litre of residual sugar. But yeah, it's a really interesting question. And actually, that's something that pops up all the time. You know, whenever I write about like the importance of styles or transparency or whatever, the one comment that is guaranteed to pop up on Twitter is somebody saying, oh, well, I bought a cider that said dry and I didn't think it was dry at all. So yeah, anyway, a rambling aside, all to say that there is lots of rules and lots of different definitions and none of them seem to make everybody happy.
Well, I think they can't, can they? Because dry is both a technical term, but as we've just heard, it technically has many different definitions. And really, it's never used as a technical term either. It's used as a technical term for labeling, but in such a broad category that it's almost meaningless. And it's used as a technical term for competition entries in particular. So, for example, we at Ross and Y run a peer-judged cider competition open to amateurs every year, where our allowance for the dry category goes up to 1,005 specific gravity, which is astoundingly high, so high that I couldn't even drink such a sweet cider. But actually, that's pretty much in the UK, that's kind of the generally agreed limit for dry categories in almost every competition. But they're not without sugar. They could have quite a lot of 1,005 specific gravity. So it's a broad thing, but I think it goes, you know, it becomes a term that we use to describe flavors and to describe our personal reaction to them. And on the kind of more standardized commercial, like newbie palate end of the scale, dry may well be applied to a Thatcher's cider that's got more sugar in than anything we produce, but which has so much tannin in it that people who aren't used to drinking ciders with tannin feel that it's dry because it has bitterness and astringency.
I mean, this was something that happened to me just the other night, actually. I was with some friends of mine, some of the very few friends of mine that I haven't sort of roped into trying sort of aspirational cider with. And we ended up sharing a bottle of the Little Pomona 3 Points, which is the Dabinet, and then one of your, Albert, your Ashton Bitters. And it was really interesting because this became a whole thing where I was saying, so this is 100% dry. But what I mean by that is it doesn't have any sugar in it. It is, however, also very tannic. And that will give a sensation of dryness and is what people often mean, or people who aren't booze nerds or in the booze industry will mean when they say dry is often, oh, it's got a significant tannic component in it. And it feels like it's drying my mouth out.
Sometimes sharpness.
Yeah.
As well.
Sharpness or anyway, some kind of intense like physical sensation in the mouth, and they will say, ah, this is dry. And this became a whole interesting topic of conversation. In any case, this actually brings us to, at long last, after a mere double-digit number of minutes, to the actual topic of the episode.
It is
now taking a step, quick step back. What do you say?
It is a Justin episode.
It is a Justin episode.
A few tangents.
It's going to be this is going to be an 8-hour episode. So, dear listeners, we have an Ellis Bitter, we have Raison d'Etre, and we have a cider made from some sort of apples from Skibbery. What unifies these? dear listeners, I'm going to give you a short moment. Maybe you could pause the podcast and think for a couple of seconds, which I will allow you to do now. What unifies these ciders? Okay, I think that's long enough. If you didn't pause it, then tough. Maybe you just came up with the answer very quickly. The answer is, inspired by our last mini episode, bittersweet apples. We're wanting to talk about bittersweets today. We're going to talk about tannin in particular, and sort of dryness, the sensation of dryness, the experience of dryness, bittersweet apples, you know, what they are, what their vibe is, how they fit into cider. Now, this is an absolutely titanic task, so don't expect anything exhaustive from us, but we're going to be giving some thoughts. So, kicking things off to the room, I'm going to just throw out a general, let's talk definitions and say, what are bittersweet apples? What makes them bittersweet? And why are they specifically referred to as bittersweet? Where did that terminology come from?
So the terms were put together at the start of the 20th century by the Long Ashton Research Station in Long Ashton, which was, well, it was a sort of research station for all sorts of things to do with, you know, horticulture and so on. But specifically, they had a sort of cider division within that. And they decided that all apples could be ranked in a sort of quadrant, I suppose. So going to one of four classes, which are sharp, sweet, bittersweet, and bitter sharp. And there are the bitter elements refers to tannin, and the sharp and sweet. Sweet does not refer to sugar. Sweet merely means lower in acidity. And sharp obviously means higher in acidity. So to be a bitter sweet, the apple needed to have more than 2 grams per liter of tannin and less than 4.5 grams per liter of titratable acidity. So, you know, bitter sharp would be one that had more than 2 grams per liter of tannin and more than 4.5 grams per liter of acidity. And again, sweet and sharp, they would have less than 2 grams per liter of tannin. So, yeah, those are the four classes of apples. By and large, most of the sorts of apples that Albert would work with in Herefordshire traditionally, or they'd have in Somerset, which is where Long Ashton is, would fall into the bittersweet and bittersharp category. That's not entirely, you know, 100%. There are some sweets and sharps as well, of course, but it's those bittersweets and bittersharps that bring the tannic qualities that ciders of the west of England are sort of renowned for, I guess. You know, these are the apples that exist really for no other purpose than the making of cider.
In which case, I'll throw that to Albert. What's the deal with bittersweets and cider in the west of England? Why bittersweets? You know, whether that's historical or whether that's stylistic, what makes these apples appealing and how did they become ubiquitous historically?
I mean, that's not an answer I can give with 100% certainty. The theory that I came across a few years...
A hot take.
Well, I reckon that historically it's because...
Have a good solid reckon.
We, you know, obviously the west of England, and particularly Herefordshire and Somerset and beyond, are relatively sparsely populated counties. And certainly they don't have... And they didn't historically have, in the 17th and centuries and earlier, a great population centre which could consume all of the possible produce that was being created in the many, many, many acres of farmland in the west of England. So the theory that I have heard and that I personally find quite convincing is that the east of England started to select eating fruit, dessert fruit, top fruit, that could more easily be transported to market at the larger population centres of London, and then historically, you know, like all the other places that had a much more prosperous kind of Renaissance period. And the west of England had to look for ways to create or grow crops that could be preserved so that their value could be fully obtained. So we started to look for cider fruit sooner, and cider making started to become more of a important part of the economy in the West. And then I think that only got kind of consolidated or made even more significant once the west coast of Britain started to be opened up for maritime trade. And to some extent, that there's a lot of argument to show that a great deal of the demand for cider in the 1700s was driven by ships stocking up to take cider on long voyages. So we started to look for cider more in this area. And essentially, cider with tannin in it is more likely to keep well for longer. So I think that could have been one of the reasons why that started to be valued and prioritized, was simply that. But at the same time, I think that to some extent, it just became the thing. It just became the palate and the flavor that people were used to. And so it started to be sought after, and it created a circular thing, which is that people wanted, or people were drinking bittersweet cider because that was what was being made. So if you wanted to start making more cider, then you had to plant bittersweet varieties or bittersharp varieties and give people cider with tannin. And because cider was so much more heavily consumed in this area than elsewhere, that's what they ended up doing. Who knows? And nowadays, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, it's gone the other way, which is, as Adam pointed out, it's an astounding thing that we are growing apples, which actually their sole purpose is for cider making. Bittersweet varieties are not enjoyable to eat. They are not useful for cooking. They are not really useful for juice. They are just for cider making because it's through the act of fermentation and maturation that they end up with a very enjoyable flavor. And without that, without those two natural processes, they aren't. However, palates and preferences have been moving away from tannin, moving away from bitterness. And so this is why this is contributing to the orchard loss that we have in the west of England right now, which is that we've got hundreds of thousands of acres of bittersweet apples. But on the industrial scale, on the macro scale, people aren't actually buying cider with tannin on with such high demand anymore. In fact, for a long time, the growth area was fruit ciders, which if you wanted to be drinking something that tasted of strawberry, why would you want it to have bitterness? That's not what you're looking for. So those consumers contributed to the grubbing up of bittersweet orchards.
Tell you what, I was really shocked by it. It was something you shared, I think, in just a WhatsApp group the other day, Albert, when you mentioned what the four most common apples planted for cider in the west of England were. And the top two, I'd have guessed, Dabinet, obviously, wonderful, fantastic, classic bittersweet, reliable, grows well, makes fabulous, characterful cider. So I'd have guessed that. And then Biscay, which is kind of Dabinet's almost sparring partner. I think you've told me it pollinates Dabinet, and you know, so it's often planted in orchards with it, but also it kind of provides something that Dabinet doesn't, because obviously, and we'll get into this later, there are bittersweets and bittersweets. You know, Michelin, as it used to be known, and Biscay as it properly is known. I nearly slipped up there and I would have got told off. But anyway, Biscay is a sort of softer and gentler, lower tannin, sort of bittersweet. And so those two are fantastic. But the other two, one of them is Falstaff, which as far as I know is a sweet. And I can't remember where it was raised. It might have been Somerset. But you know, it is totally the other end of the spectrum from anything you would kind of expect from a Western England, you know, West Country, three counties, South Wales, cider apple. And then Gilly, which I believe was one of the apples that Bulmers kind of propagated in the late 70s, early 80s. I might be very wrong there, but I know they propagated a lot of apples they named after people. And that, I think you grow a little bit of Gilly, don't you, Ali? It's like a mild bitter sharp, is it? Or...
So, yeah, you're touching on the truth in all of that. Falstaff is from Kent. Gilly is part of the project that Bulmers were kind of, as far as I know, I think they were co-funding, but actually it was really being headed by Liz Copas and Long Ashton. It was like the last great contribution of Long Ashton to British pomology before the centre was shut down. And they released around 25 varieties that started to kind of become available to buy. I think it was actually the 90s, but obviously it takes a long time for that project, so I think it was a multi-decade-long project.
Is it so recent that that became so ubiquitous, the Gilly?
Yeah, genuinely, as Adam said, Gilly was propagated in this project and it didn't exist before that. And I don't actually think Gilly has any tannin, so I would just be calling it a sharp, but I could be wrong. And we don't actually grow any. We bought some a few years ago. Sorry, you're right, Adam. According to Frank Matthews, it's a bitter sharp, but I don't remember.
This is it. I've seen it listed as a bitter sharp, but whenever I've tried a single variety of Gilly, which isn't super super often, I'm not, you know, I can't confess to be hugely familiar with it, but it has never felt like there's any real tannin to me. But anyway, yeah. So I was really, you know, shocked to see those two in, you know, the four main cider apple varieties grown in the three counties and Somerset. You know, it's and it really does, you know, it's a scary sign of the times. And I think tannin is just, well, we had, I loved the discussion that we had at CraftCon, which we talked a bit about last week. You know, and the insights that Polly and Tam and James Forbes were all able to share into how
but
you
not
work
Martin.
With tannin. Well, Martin was coming at it from the how you kind of put them in front of consumers direction, right? I mean, he wasn't coming from a like the making perspective so much. He was talking about, you know, how you know wonderful tannic cider can be when you put it with like the right foods, or you kind of explain to customers what this thing is meant to be, right? I mean, tannin is unusual to people who haven't encountered tannic drinks before, and most people haven't. Tannin is, because I don't think we've said, it is a plant polyphenol, and it's found in pretty much all plants. So any, you know, loads of the drinks that you have, tea has tannin. That's why if you brew tea for a long time, it you know, it has that drying sensation on your gums, which is where you feel tannin. Lots of red wines particularly have it, because tannin in wines comes from the skins of the grapes. So if you've had an orange wine, which is like a white wine that has been made on its skins, you know, it hasn't had the skins removed at pressing, you know, these things all have tannins. And, you know, so a huge amount of work has gone in into the wine industry to try and reduce the amount of tannin that there is in a lot of red wines. So, you know, people trying to make commercial wines are really trying to kind of filter those tannins out, strip them out as much as they can. You know, they're really, really heavily working the wine. But then other winemakers, I mean, some of the best wines in the world owe a huge amount of their character to the fact that they've got a significant tannic element. So, you know, Bordeaux and Barolo would be the first two that would jump to my mind if I was asked to think of a wine that's famously tannic. And again, they're two of the longest lived, most treasured styles of wine that there are. But at the same time, if somebody said, you know, here's a bottle of Bordeaux, it's, you know, from a fantastic vineyard or chateau, and it's from last vintage, I probably wouldn't, you know, just open it there and then and expect something that was going to be like easy to drink and perfectly in its condition already, you know. And therein lies the challenge, I guess, and you'll be able to talk better about this than me, Albert, but therein lies the challenge for the maker, is when you have something that is designed to age really, really well, you know, something that's got lots and lots of tannins which just gradually break down and soften, but it takes real time. You know, either you have to find some way of removing as much of that astringency and bitterness as early as you can, and that, I guess, leads a lot of people into a path of manipulation, or you have to really explain to people what it is and hope that they're going to serve it with the right food. You know, maybe save it for a little longer. You know, in wine, lots of wines, people do things like decanting. You know, so it's difficult, because you don't ever want to say, oh, you need to know stuff to be able to appreciate this. But certainly I remember not appreciating tannic drinks early in my drinking journey, and thinking, oh, this is bitter, I'm not sure about this feels odd. And then as I learned a little, tannic, you know, styles of wine and cider have become some of my absolute favorite drinks of all. But it is an unusual sensation. I've talked in several circles there, and for an extended period, as is my wont, but hopefully a few points have sort of quasi-landed.
I absolutely think so. I mean, there's a whole pile of questions that are bubbling away in me. As a little observation, tannin being, and bitterness, I guess, in general, is a sort of developed taste. I don't think an acquired taste makes it sound too obscure. But just before the episode started, we were discussing that I shared this Ellis Bitter with my partner, Deanna. She's relatively new to sort of aspirational cider, and especially sort of dry bittersweet cider. But she's immediately found really likes it, really enjoys it, and actually tacks towards relatively dry and tannic juice, despite not having had any time as it were, getting to know the drink. Adam's pulling a face.
You just tied a juice.
Yes, I did, unfortunately. You've infected me with your discussion of whiskey nerds calling it juice, and now I can't help myself. But what's interesting about that is that, you know, she comes from Tabasco in Mexico, as I've mentioned many, many times, and that food culture has a lot of, like, quite dry, bitter flavours in, like, you know, raw chocolate or mole or, you know, a whole pile of the other sauces that have this kind of bitterness just very much integrated into it. And so if you're coming at it with a palate that's already primed to understand how bitterness can be enjoyable, how bitterness can unlock a number of other flavours, I feel like you don't need to do that, okay, then here's a bitter sweet cider, it's going to be bitter, sort of priming work. 100%. If you come from a food culture that already has that. Which brings me actually to polyphenols. What the fuck is a polyphenol, Adam?
Justin, what if I told you that a polyphenol is a tannin? And a tannin is a polyphenol?
Oh, are they just the same thing?
Pretty much.
Adam gritting his teeth and spitting out visible dental grit.
I was just really excited that Albert was prepared to field your question on that one, because I can confidently tell you that tannins are plant polyphenols, but if you ask me to say what a polyphenol is, I guess it's some kind of... We know what my scientific capacity is, but I'm going to chuck it out there and say, is it a compound? Is that what a polyphenol is?
A rich, informing, and insightful take from Adam.
It's a class of compound. Polyphenols is a class of compound found in many plant foods. They include flavonoids, phenolic acids, lignans, and still beans. So there you go. That's the layman's definition
still
of polyphenols.
Still beans?
Well, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but it's spelled STILBENES. And if that's not still beans, then
still beans.
Well, there are several ways you could theoretically pronounce that. I have guessed one with zero knowledge whatsoever. Well, thank you not to mock my ignorance.
All right, Adam, still your beans.
I think the key thing for people to understand about tannins and polyphenols, you don't have to be able to assess them on a molecular level and completely get what's going on in the biology. But tannins they contribute mouthfeel and texture. And phenolic compounds, of which tannins are one and the same, basically, you know, for the level that we need to get into to enjoy our cider and to understand our cider, we don't need to go any... Yeah, we don't have to break
them
down.
Don't make me guess at the pronunciation of still beans. You don't need to know it. They're the textural thing that you feel on the front of your gums that contributes like almost a sense of grip.
But it's more than that as well, because it's like you were saying.
And this is what I want to ask, is the extended question I had was that tannic ciders often have some quite distinct flavours to them, which, you know, what's that about? Like, what's going on there where you say, oh, this is phenolic or something like
that? Yeah, so as I was literally
explaining... Say what you were going to say anyway. I wanted to feel like I was having input.
Justin's in charge!
I am the host. I must assert myself.
So, with cider, we get certain apples in this bittersweet character. Some of them have a small amount of tannin, which we call soft bittersweets. So varieties like Somerset Red Streak, which for me... as the grower and cider maker, is characterized by a not too strong flavor. It has more flavor than, say, an eating apple that you ferment, but basically it has a moderate amount of bitterness. It has low to zero astringency, at least in my interpretation of the apple, and it leaves a lot of room for kind of classic apple aromas and flavors. For me, Somerset Red Streak always has the aroma of lovely, bright red apples. And part of that is because it doesn't have such a high tannin content that the phenols are getting in the way of the other stuff that makes an apple an apple. Whereas a variety like Major, in cider making terms, we would describe as a full bittersweet, by which we mean there's a lot of tannins in there. Now, Major, again, isn't super astringent, but it has so many different types of phenolic compounds that it has the opportunity, depending on the vintage, where it was grown, the health of the tree, the style of fermentation, to present a lot of flavors and a lot of aromas that are only possible because of the composition of that apple. And that composition is an apple that has a lot of phenols. So we might interpret these flavors as being, say, woody or farmy or barnyard or medicinal or peaty. These kinds of things as
savory, I guess.
Savory. You could say savory, as well as having classic apple character, where we've got acidity and ripe fruit and everything else. And so to get the best out of a bittersweet, it's about working with those tannins to express the most enjoyable flavors from them.
And that's also a really, I mean, a point you made there, all of that was brilliant, but a point you made there that I think is really key is going back to what we said earlier about, you know, there's bittersweets and bittersweets. So you get some, Major is a great example, Dabner, I'd say as well, Yarlington Mill, where they've also got big sugars, big flavors beyond just the phenolics from the tannins. And that means that the sensation of tannin is lessened because the body and the fruit that you get from the level of alcohol that comes through the sugar, you know, and everything else, you know, it gives more structural balance. Whereas you get some apples, and Chisel Jersey would be one. We talked about a blend I tasted last week from Torn Plant that was Dabner and Chisel Jersey, and I was really impressed that something which had one of the two apples as Chisel Jersey had managed to find that balance, because that is an apple where the tannins are so astringent, but the body is not on the same level as Dabner. So you have this, you know, it doesn't balance quite as easily, or it needs a lot more time for the tannins to soften, or they kind of need to be managed in a particular way. And so bittersweet is a huge, huge, broad umbrella that falls over a vast, vast spectrum of apples. And there isn't the equivalent in wine. You know, people would just talk about something being tannic or something being not. It's a unique categorization, and I sometimes think that it, by classing only in terms of tannin and acid, you lose the important other nuances of flavor. But it's a fantastic and useful starting point to have.
Just to pick up on something that you said there, Adam, the idea of tannin and aging. I'm terrible at being pessimistic when I'm talking, especially about bittersweet cider, but kind of a lot of stuff with aspirational cider. I'm always like, oh, it's so hard to get people to try it and stuff like that. And if bittersweets were just difficult to market and had no positives, why would anybody fucking bother? There's so much that they can bring. If they weren't nice, you'd be like, I'm making a horrible drink that nobody wants to buy. I'm going to go and make something else. The fact of the matter is that it's not. Is that there is something deeply captivating and important about them, that they really do bring something unique and interesting. So we've talked about phenolic flavors, about how they bring these interesting, savory, barnyardy, woody. I always think of them as kind of richer flavors, that they have this kind of weightiness to them. One of the other things that I understand tannin brings is a capacity to age. So I want to throw that out to you guys about like tannin and aging. What's going on there?
One of the things that polyphenols do is they act as an antioxidant. So if you have tannin in a cider, and this goes back to what I was saying, where centuries ago they started to prioritize it because they realized the cider kept for longer. But basically the tannins give the cider protection. And when they're young, when there's an abundance of them, you can have very intense flavors. You can have a lot more bitterness than you might desire. You could have a lot more astringency than you might desire. And if those tannins are exposed to oxygen, or if the cider is exposed to oxygen deliberately or inadvertently, which often historically is the case and still is the case for many producers, if you have tannin in the cider, they will, rather than the cider immediately breaking down and in the aerobic environment, acetobacter create acetic acid and you get volatile acidity and your cider starts going off, depending on your level of tannin, you will have some level of protection, and that process might be delayed whilst instead the tannins bind with the oxygen. And in the consequence of that is A, that your cider doesn't go off, but B, the tannin load of the cider gets reduced. So as time passes, whether this maturation is being done, well, in some kind of aerobic environment. Now, you don't want a lot of oxygen. Typically, what people refer to it as is microoxidation or microoxygenation. So a barrel is the perfect example of this. It's one of the primary reasons why barrels are used to mature tannic ciders, is because that slow exposure to oxygen allows the tannins to bind with it, keep the cider fresh, but for the weight of the cider, the mouthfeel, the level of bitterness to slowly reduce. And in doing so, we can take a cider that is made from a certain variety of apple, which has a certain esteemed quality and flavor, but when it's young, might be from that same apple, not quite at its peak in terms of drinking. It can go through this maturation process to where it achieves at its peak. And so you might say, well, that seems like a lot of faff. Why don't we just use a variety that doesn't have to be matured? But that's because actually this process of maturation allows you to develop other flavors that aren't present in any kind of variety when the cider is 6 months old. It allows you to use certain varieties which have a unique flavor but just happen to have loads and loads of tannin, such as the Ellis Bitter that you're drinking. And it also just allows the cider to develop in an interesting way, no matter what. And it can lead us to a way to value what we're drinking that isn't necessarily possible if it's made from a variety of apple that doesn't have polyphenols that allow it to age.
Listeners can't see this, but both Adam and I are nodding with just very sort of like, yes, absolutely not much else
it
to
also,
say. On
it
my
also
part,
undergrad, but... I must admit I missed half of it because I'm under heavy attack from a quite impatient cat at the moment. But it sounded great, the bits that I heard. And yeah, 100%. Like, acid and tannin are like the two, you know, if you're going to have something that's going to age, ideally you want one or both of those.
The other thing to point out is that not all aging is to do with oxygen. So with raison d'etre, for example, this cider is 15 months old or so when it goes into bottle. It's matured for another 5 months before it's released. And then the one I'm drinking has had another 2.5 years after that point, all in bottle. So if it's in bottle, this is an inert environment. There's no oxygen transfer between the outside world through the glass into the cider. Now, if you're using a cork, that's slightly different. But for us, we're bottling with crown caps. We're not getting any oxygen transfer. But there is still maturation going on. And the tannins, first of all, because there's a minute amount of oxygen remaining in the cider, either it's obviously bottles have an air gap, right? So we're doing bottle conditioning where we're consuming a lot of that oxygen because the yeast need it to actually do the in-bottle fermentation to have the natural sparkle. But it may still leave some oxygen. And also you get dissolved oxygen in liquid in cider anyway. So you need some kind of tannin to help you cope with the dissolved oxygen that's in there. But also when the yeast have finished conditioning, they're going down on the bottom of the bottle. And then theoretically magic happens. So the breakdown of these yeast cells, as well as the tannins binding with the little amount of oxygen that's in there, blah, 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 stuff is going on in the bottle and it is changing. And often in ways, especially if it's in a cider where the producer has imagined it from the ground up to have this potential for aging, then we end up with a flavor that, you know, is revealed almost. Because when it was young, the tannin content there was shrouding the flavor. There was too much tannin that the real intricacies of the cider weren't being revealed, but they come out after a length of time.
I'd also say that that can work both in the bottle and out of the bottle. I mean, that is literally the point of decanting, right? It's to allow, you know, it's to kind of speed up that reaction between oxygen and the you know, the tannins and all this sort of stuff. You know, that's literally why people decant. I'm no good on the actual science, but it's to you know, get some oxygen in and to allow those polyphenols to like unclench, I guess, and let the fruit express itself a little bit more. But I think this also, I mean, the existence of tannin, and we've touched on this, is a big reason. Well, people taking the really, really, you know, big brands taking the really easy thing of, well, we'll get rid of the tan, you know, the bittersweet trees and replant them with something less tannic. But also, you know, it's either, well, can we sort of, you know, filter out as much of this tannic content as possible, or, you know, use a bit more water, a bit more concentrate, or this sort of thing. But even, you know, beyond that, it's also why a lot of, you know, full juice producers, the longer you store a cider, the more space it takes up, and you know, that's all costing money. Like space is a premium. And one way that people, I think, deal with very, very tannic ciders is to bottle something a bit sweeter, you know, whether that be the natural sugars of the apple or you know, sweetening, you know, back sweetening or whatever it might be. And so I suspect that sugar is used to try and counteract tannin quite often, to try and balance those tannins so that the cider is kind of more broadly appealing at a younger age, right? I mean, I think, and this is not just me looking to shill for Ross or blow any smoke in Albert's direction, but I think that dry, bittersweet cider is, you know, in its way, it's the hardest style to make because you don't have any of that sugar that's heightening the sense of body and fruit and reducing the sense of astringency. So if you're going to do that, then the tannins really need to either develop or like, you know, be matched with the right sort of food. I also think that we should get onto tannins with food because that, to me, is the real theoretical magic of the lot, you know. And I think that tannins with food really is kind of bittersweet cider's route to glory.
Well, if you want to lead that, tannins and food, like famously, cheese and tannic wine, red wine, are famous friends. Cheese and cider, charcuterie and cider.
Not only would I object to that as a you know, cheese hater or a cheese hated, I would say, but I certainly know our friend Rachel wouldn't take kindly to red wine and cheese being blanket paired together. But I think, yeah, the capacity of tannic food to match beautifully with tannic drink to match beautifully with different sorts of foods is absolutely unbelievable. You know, when I started out in the wine industry, I was working for Majestic Wine in the shops, and every month we would host a like wine 101 that people could come along to for free, and they'd try six different wines, and you know, we'd go for three reds, three whites, and I'd be trying to show different styles. And one of the wines that I would be expected to pair would be a really young, deliberately very, very tannic Bordeaux to explain what tannins were. And this generally would be the most expensive wine in the lineup. And without fail, when we tasted through them all, it was the one that most people would go, oh, no, I'm not sure about that. That's very dry. That's very bitter. You know, all that sort of thing. And people would generally prefer things like the Sauvignons or the lower tannin red wines. And then we would pair things with different sorts of food. And my brief was to do deliberately good matches and also deliberately bad matches. So I had to do combinations that didn't work, but I also had to do combinations that did. And so one of the food pairings would be something that was high in protein, so like either a cheddar cheese or like some charcuterie, some meat with the tannic red wine. And what happens when you pair tannin with protein is that they literally bind together. So the tannin will chemically bind with the protein, and in doing so, the sensation will literally soften in your mouth. So the same thing happens that Albert was talking about earlier, where the astringency is gone, but all of the flavors of the fruit are therefore to the fore. And that, to me, the first time I ever experienced that, I was like, that is unbelievable. You know, and that was kind of where I realized, you know, oh, there actually is something to food and drink matching. You know, and often it's, you know, just pair what you like with what you like. And lots of it sort of, I feel, is overblown. But tannin and protein is actual proper magic chemistry is what it is. So I would very heartily endorse things like what Albert does and Martin does at the Yew Tree with like steak and raisin and things like that. Yeah, tannin loves protein. That is very, very important. It's why we've talked a lot about wine, but it's why people pair things like Bordeaux or whatever with roast lamb or roast beef or what have you.
If I can go back a bit towards the start, to talk a bit more about, you know, about tannins and how we experience them. You know, Adam, I wonder if the cider you're drinking isn't actually that tannic, would you say?
Well, if we're doing a 1 to 10 spectrum of tannins, 1 still having some tannin, then I would say that this is... Yeah, I am. I'm reminding myself. I don't want to get this wrong. I have my reputation. I'd say this was about a 4.
This is one of the ways that tannin interacts with dryness. We can have a cider that has less sugar, and depending on how smooth the tannins are, the quantity of tannins, and obviously also the interplay with acidity, the real fruitiness of cider can come through. I mean, cider is fermented fruit juice. It should be fruity. It shouldn't necessarily need sugar to still be fruity. And ciders that are quote-unquote very dry in terms of how we perceive their flavour are often so because they have a high amount of bitterness and a high amount of astringency, so they literally dry our mouths out. They literally give us the physical sensation of having the saliva removed from our mouth, because the saliva is being consumed, it's been bound by the tannins and being taken away. But also, we can end up with a cider that doesn't have enough tannin, a cider that... not that it doesn't have enough tannin, but what is dry to someone with a moderate amount of tannin may be coming across as actually lacking tannin for someone else, depending on your preference, depending on your palate. And there's definitely some ciders at Ross & Y. I mean, the big one, actually, the kind of one that's most pertinent to this is the 2020 vintage of Raison d'Etre. This is a cider of absolutely no sugar, but because the 2020 vintage is 75% Biscay, 25% Dabernet, and all the other vintages of Raison are more or less the reverse, we have a much, much lower tannin content in 2020. And so actually, to us at the farm, when we're drinking 2020, because there's still about a fair amount of it left, especially by the bottle, when we're drinking a small amount, we actually really kind of missed the bitterness. We actually, you know, that one, when it came out and now, was a raison that was notable for being very light, very smooth, very easy. And in fact, almost, or, you know, depending on your interpretation of it, almost sweet. Because it didn't have the tannin and particularly the bitterness, which provides structure and gives you something to balance the fruitiness that the other vintages have. And so this I think is something that's really interesting when we're looking at bittersweet cider and we're trying to assess the flavors and whether we like them or not necessarily quality one way or the other, but whether we like them ourselves personally or not. 2020 has always stood out like that because it didn't have so much dab in it. The barrel was doing a lot of work, the fruit was doing a lot of work, the maturation was doing a lot of work. Very almost sweet cider, even though there's no sugar.
Epic. Can I also say, before we go into Justin's final section, we've talked a lot about like the science and all this sort of thing and proteins and polyphenols and still beans and all this sort of stuff. But bittersweet cider is amazing. It is cider's crown jewel. Like, which isn't to say that cider without tannin can't be amazing and staggering. And, you know, God, I've certainly written up some in, you know, the however many hundred reviews we've done on Cider Review. But bittersweet and bitter sharp ciders are, you know, it's wild to think there are only two places in the world where these apples are grown in quantity. And every cider maker in the rest of the world would love to have access to more bittersweet and bitter sharp fruit. And it is the biggest USP within cider. You know, you put a bittersweet or a bitter sharp, a really, really good one, in front of somebody, and you know, if it's a really extreme one, like we've talked about, like something really young or like it's a really big bitter sharp, like Foxwell, that's just got so much going on, they might like go, oh my God, what's this? It's too much, or all at once. Or they, you know, that might be the cider that makes them go, Jesus, this is a huge flavor. This is incredible. Who knew cider could be like this? Because it is the furthest from like what people generally expect cider to be. You know, a really great dry bittersweet cider is as far as you can get from the stuff, the macro brand stuff that that we all know from taps in every pub in the UK. It is an astonishing, marvelous drink that just absolutely has the power to change minds. I mean, I remember when we had Fliss on, a few months ago. And her reaction to Brown Snout was like, I've never had something like this. This is like the most apple ever. This is, it was awesome. You know, that's what bittersweet cider can be and is. And that's kind of what I think the intention of this episode originally was going to be like, oh my God, bittersweet cider. It's so good. tannins are amazing, and we've kind of slipped a little bit into the kind of qualifying the amazingness of tannins that that cider, you know, generally and inevitably has got into out of fear that people will go, oh, astringency, oh, dryness. But, you know, I think we live in a time where people are coming back to big flavors again. I mean, Tam made the great point in the Bittersweets panel that we've kind of got more used to sweeter and more processed food in the last few decades, certainly in the West and in the UK. You know, that's kind of been the culinary story of the last 50 years. But people are interested in big flavors again. We see this in drinks. You know, we see this in craft beer. We see this in, single malt whiskey. We see this in the kind of cocktails that people drink now that have significant bittering components in. I mean, Negronis are huge again and all these sorts of things. And, you know, bitterness and astringency are a little bit different, and that should be qualified. You know, the bitterness of a bittersweet apple is different than the bitterness of a Negroni, for instance. But these are our like big statement making ciders. These are kind of the sort of thing that, you know, if you try them and you love them, you'll never ever be able to just be like, no, I'm going back to the sort of cider I had before.
Absolutely.
Yeah, damn right.
I want to say, I wasn't trying to qualify out bitters like tannins. I just think that if you know what they are, you love them even more. That's all.
I've maybe misspoke. Yeah. But you know, and I was as well. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's very easy to fall into I don't know. Anyway.
I know what you're saying. I mean, I think we can be fearful about presenting a cider with tannin to someone because it's a flavour that they are simply not used to experiencing. Especially the way tannins present in ciders, it's really a unique thing. And as you're saying as well, it's unique to this area of the world here and northern France, and that's it. And so it's really a marvel every time we drink bittersweet cider together and we share it together. It's just a marvel. That we get to enjoy such a unique thing.
With you. And I think, yeah, like, I mean, I have that now where, like, there's so many wonderful ciders out there, and yet I find myself sort of gravitating towards ones that have a significant tannin component or bittersweet component to them, because you just don't get flavors like that elsewhere. And it's not a matter of that the other flavors are better or worse. It's a matter of just uniqueness. That it's just like, these are so utterly of themselves. I can't think of anything else that really tastes like bittersweet cider. It tastes of itself. It's unique and it's great and it's delicious. And it's also that total experience. You know, we've talked extensively about the textural component, about how if you do have something that's got some really great tannins, it's not just yum yum taste good. It's an entire, you know, it's the whole physical experience of tasting it, of that drying or that grip, the interplay it has with food, the finish where you get that lovely sort of sensation in your mouth that carries with it some of the flavor compounds as well. But I mean, kind of as I was saying earlier, if they, you know, considering that sometimes we've been, and I apologize for my part in this, but perhaps a little bit on the back foot about it through this episode, I know I've been being like, oh, what are these? And oh, it's difficult. As I said, like a couple of minutes ago, they make fucking awesome drinks. They're really tasty. They're really interesting. Yeah. Why bother? Because they're great. And for all the doomsaying, I suppose we sometimes do, I'm sure most people listening to this will agree with us that they provide a unique and fascinating and delicious drink that you, it just doesn't exist elsewhere, simply because it is its own thing. It is a drink. It is bittersweet cider, and that is what it is. In the same way that, you know, you can't get an apple that tastes of, I don't know, a tuna sandwich. They're different and wonderful for different reasons. Very off the wall analogy there.
Have you ever eaten hawthorn leaves?
I have indeed eaten hawthorn leaves. I have indeed. Famously, I've munched on hawthorn leaves. Yeah, you can't make Yeah, they're moderately bitter. They're not as astringent as I recall. But as I've mentioned, as it turns out, we have the less flavorful variety of Hawthorn in the Midlands. So apparently there's a tastier one. But yeah, good for vitamin C allegedly as well. There we go. It's interesting coming back to what you were saying earlier about the cider for sea journeys as well, and how that ties into what Aritz was saying in our Basque episode. Well, seeing as we are reaching the end of the episode, we're going to be playing a quick game. And we've spent an extensive amount of time talking about the sort of, you know, the sort of real, you know, lightning bolt from the heavens, exquisite, you know, massage to within an inch of its life food pairings. But I want to sort of flip things around and go for a little bit more of a kind of homey food pairing today, where we're going to take various snack foods and junk foods and takeaway foods, and we are going to talk about what bittersweet cider we would pair with them. So I'm gonna throw out some offers. You guys feel free to throw some in. I'm gonna start with saying, right, I have just demolished a packet of what I call how's this pronounced? I don't speak Polish. Przinki party pack, which are like a kind of a smoky bacon flavored crisp. So if I was to have some bacon flavored crisps, what would you pair with them? What would you do with them?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, where to start?
This is going to be a very bad
The
section.
Problem is, like, okay, they're bacon flavored, but they're just carb. So they're probably quite salty, I guess. So, you know, they're going to be fine with anything. But
I'm going to say bacon, that you wouldn't want to go too tannic on that, because salt heighten, like, there are things in there that, like, heighten astringency. So I think that you want, like, something like, I would say, a Somerset Red Streak or a Brown Snout, something that is all about the middle. As Albert often brilliantly puts it, you know, something that's like pure fruit, and the structure is there, but it's really like integrated with the fruit. And this is not just a cop out because we always go for Brown Snout, but I think that the additional depth that Brown Snout maybe has compared to Somerset Red Streak would go with the fact that you've got smoke in there and meat and flavors in there. So I am going to start with Brown Snout for your beautifully pronounced random pack of crisps that you had to check what they were.
And we can also give a quick shout out to Biscay, which would also be suitable in that absolutely realm of soft bittersweet cider.
That's a great shout. I will say, when we do go for things like Brown Snout, we're like, oh no, we've gone for this again. It's because it's great, Adam. It's really good.
If in doubt, Brown Snout.
Right, so having chowed down on my enormous bag of delicious bacon flavor crisps, I've decided the next thing on my itinerary is a big old margarita pizza. So if I'm going to get like a proper, you know, you get it delivered and it comes in the generic box, which doesn't have the brand on. It's just like the pizza box.
Yeah, pizza is great on the box.
Yeah, exactly. And I can see Adam's got blood pouring from his eyes. But just a generic, like, margarita or a pepperoni pizza, what would your ideal thing with that be?
It differs. So the thing is with a margarita by itself, unless you've got a white margarita without tomato sauce, then the amount of acidity from the tomato is going to kind of leave you in a difficult spot if you're looking for a pure bittersweet cider. I think you'd again be leading into having something softer, something that wasn't too challenging, something that would kind of balance the acidity and the greasiness of this dirty margarita. So Somerset Red Streak would be great, kind of leading into sort of more medium high bittersweet apples like a Dabernet, but you wouldn't want to go so far as a Chisel Jersey, an Ellis Bitter, or anything down that end of the spectrum. However, if you're going to have a pepperoni pizza, or better yet, some kind of like spiced meat pizza, when you've got that extra...
Yeah, like a sloppy just...
Yeah, when you got that extra heat, then you can really start to have some fun, because we've got the things we want. We've got a lot of protein from the meat, from the cheese, we've got fat from the cheese, we can really go for a really big, bold cider. And spiciness is something that pairs so perfectly with tannin. And I don't know if this is chemically accurate, but for me, bittersweet cider pretty much is as effective as like milk in terms of balancing spice, right? If you have something super spicy and you're like, give me dairy products, well, have them in spice and have bittersweet cider with it, and it's like a heightened experience.
So spice, then this is always a difficulty with wine doesn't go very well with spice, because what spice does is it heightens the sense of alcohol. So if you had a cider that was low in body and high in alcohol, that might struggle. But when you've got something like Dabernet or Yarlington Mill, right, that you know, they're half the alcohol of wine, but they also have a really, really big fruity body, you know, that they're not so high alcohol that the spice is going to make them seem astringent. And they've got all that fruitiness that goes kind of really, really well. So I think, I mean, and again, you know, I'm not a scientist, but based on everything that I've ever learned about food pairing, that would be like why they work super, super well.
On a related note, if we're going down the spice route, then I've hopped into my local supermarket of choice, and I have grabbed a microwave Gelfrazi, specifically a Gelfrazi for the chili content, the particular flavour profile there. Adam stretching and cracking his knuckles there. Looks like he wants to take this one.
Well, if it is a chicken curry, then your only option to have is a Somerset Red Streak, and you must beat Norman to curry before eating it. No, I mean, if we're talking about that level of spice, then you definitely don't want to go too tannic, because spice can, as we've said, heighten astringency a little bit. But Somerset Red Streak has what Albert said earlier, this lovely, like, juicy, nice. It's got a lovely sense of body. It's got like that little bit of tannin to add some grip. Really early on in my learning single varieties, Albert cooked me an amazing chicken curry when we were going through, and we just happened to have it with Somerset Red Streak, and I still think of that as one of my all-time best cider and food pairings that I've ever had. But unfortunately, the pan was left untended, and Norman took advantage.
I like that we have just said, for all of his pairings, just drink Somerset Red Streak. I mean, it's yeah. Such a good apple. There's
Somerset Red Streak or Brown Snout.
Well, to be fair, I mean... Like,
and also that I've been like, here's a very acidic thing, and people have been like, oh, that's going to be hard with a strong.
The nature of doing this, like, you know, and I found this when I was once like challenged to come up with a bunch of different pairings for different meals I might have bought from the chip shop, and they're all really high fat, and some of them aren't that high protein, right? So acid is as much of your friend. Whereas if you were to say, for instance, Justin, like you're pairing for a sausage sandwich, there you've got something for the tannins to kind of sink their teeth into.
Mm.
But when it's mainly carbs and fat, you know, it's not that these things won't go well. It's just that they're not like tannins' happiest stomping ground.
In that case, having mentioned sausage sandwiches, let's push it even further. And let's say you've got an extremely high quality sausage roll. What are you going to be pairing with that?
The sausage roll. Now you're talking. I mean, Dabernet is an excellent starting point for that, I think, because you know that will be exactly what we were talking about earlier. You know, it's got so much body and so much fruit. The tannins will just sink their teeth into the pork, and it will be, you know, and Dabernet's already got, you know, so much body and fruit that it just goes beautifully with. It balances well despite being fairly high tannin. But I think that potentially an even more magical match would be if you went with Major, because Major is kind of, it's got elements of its flavor profile that to me always remind me of Dabernet in some ways. It's got like the oranginess, but it definitely has a more like phenolic and occasionally astringent finish. And like some of its flavors tack to my taste of the Majors and the Dabernets that I've had in a slightly more savory direction than Dabernet. And I think that would work super well with a sausage roll, because what you would find there is the same thing that you find from some of the oak cask majors that Albert does, where the oak has just allowed all the fruit to shine, but has like almost mopped up the astringency on the finish a little bit, so it's all that bit smoother, and binding with the protein would have exactly the same effect. So I think like Dabernet would be a great shout. but major will be the, oh my God, something's happened to this cider kind of pairing.
I also think that one option could be a Bulmers Norman. So a variety that's not so heralded, but is going in the same way that you're talking about there. And Bulmers Norman, for me, has always got a bit of apricot to it. So it's got a bit of fruit there to go with some pork, some really, really nice citrusy, well, like high citrus notes. And it's also, in fact, there's a Bulmers Norman from last year. It's kind of even got a pastry texture to it. It's a kind of brioche-y, toasty, pastry, this kind of flavor, just in the background. So it could be really enjoyable to have that with a really good sausage roll, especially the ones that my auntie produces. They're massive. And they've got like tomato chutney, and then so you know they've got loads of stuff there that makes them way better than a Greg's. You know, Greg's sausage roll is fine, but pairing Greg's sausage roll with some real high quality cider is a bit of a mismatch. But if you've got an artisanal sausage roll with something really fancy and
possible, to not be going artisanal.
Caroline definitely cites the Broom Farm sausage rolls as her all-time favourite sausage rolls.
They are pretty great. Once again, shilling for all things Broom Farm. Well, let's flip this on its head and do one more. Let's say I've just had my Ellis Bitter here. So if I was to grab a 500ml bottle, I'll go down to my local corner shop in London. And obviously, they'll have an enormous selection of single variety full juice ciders. And I'll just grab one of those of a Friday night and go, oh, I'm going to have a chilled night in. I'm going to have some junk food. And I'm going to have my single variety cider that I can obviously just pull out of the cooler in my local shop. What am I going to grab from the corner shop to go with that, like to snack on as I binge watch my TV show or play video games or...
Before we get into what you pair it with, I think that a point that we haven't made is that bittersweet cider can often suffer from being kept at too cool a temperature, right? Because you've said that you're going to grab out of the cooler, but if you had a very tannic cider, the chemistry of these phenols is that if you cool them, they really, really clench, you know, and they become more astringent, and that heightens astringency, which is one of the reasons that you have red wine at a warmer temperature than you have like white wine. It's that tannins and lack of tannins. So I'm not saying this to be horrible to you. Sorry, this is something I realized we hadn't said in the episode, but it's really, really key because loads of cider is just, and I certainly used to do this. I used to just by default put all ciders in the fridge. And then I discovered that in doing so, I was making, you know, I wasn't giving ciders their best chance, and I wasn't serving them the way that I could enjoy them the most. So definitely a point that we should raise is that, you know, if you're drinking bittersweet cider or you're newer to bittersweet cider, really just give dry bittersweet cider, give it a chance at room temperature, or maybe like just tiny bit cooler than room temperature. Like, you know, all of the best dry bittersweets I've ever had were tasted usually in a barn. So barn temperature, if you can get to that.
Well,
but anyway, sorry.
Well, this is all an extremely good point and a very important public service announcement. However, we already have our mythical corner shop that has a wide variety of single variety ciders. And I think it would be too much to also expect this mythical corner shop to be holding them in ideal. You know, you got to pick your battles, Adam. They might not be held in the ideal storage temperature. But from the insert appropriate receptacle here, what are you going to be pairing with?
From the corner shop range, I would pick up some beef jerky.
Mmm, yeah.
Oh, what a
and
great
it,
shout,
it would be a light supper. Probably a subsequent 500ml bottle to follow to fill the hole.
A light cholesterol and sodium heavy supper. Right, so what about, I mean, you know, we've talked extensively about meat as a pairing. Is there anything vegetarian you'd pick up snack-wise?
Yeah, I mean, cheese is veggie. A lot of cheeses are, and that's a great option. And if you want something totally vegan, then jackfruit can be a great starting point. If we served at our supper club last year, jackfruit bulgogi. So we had all the flavor and depth of the jackfruit, put it through the spicy sweet marinade, and then you have something that's really contrasting in a nice way with bittersweet cider, basically, which is what we paired it with.
Hell yeah. I've never actually had jackfruit, to my shame. Never actually enjoyed it. Well, not never enjoyed it. Enjoyed it in terms of I've never consumed it. I'm sure I would enjoy it if I consumed it, he says, desperately backpedaling. right, so we've got jackfruit or beef jerky to go with our Aurelis Bitter. Right, well, I think that we are reaching the end of our allotted time slot. Any more? Any other hot takes on bittersweets and tannins?
I don't have hot takes on bittersweets and tannins that we haven't already said, but I do want to plug, because I'm quite excited about it, and we haven't plugged it yet, the fact that my book is now an actual physical thing, which I'm really excited about. I received my copy. Now, listeners can't see it, but they can hear it. That's the sound of a book. You can't do that with a Microsoft Word file. And if you do, you'll break your computer. So,
ironically enough, the sound actually cut out as you were doing that, Adam. So there was no noise.
I apologize. It goes, there you are. That's the sound of a book. It is now a physical, properly available thing, and I haven't obsessed and just gone through it looking for typos. I haven't done that, but it's available to buy from Camera's website, but also from a selection of the obvious online book retailers. But you know, ideally, if you can, don't buy from the most obvious online retailer, because you know, if you Google Perrier Drinker's Guide. Still available to pre-order, and May the 3rd we'll be at the Yew Tree drinking lots of Perry, but also, I'm sure, quite a lot of bittersweet cider as well when we launch it.
Fabulous. Albert, any plugs?
I just want to say that the survey that Adam mentioned at the start of the episode, which is conducted, is partly government-funded, it's official survey, has shown that we are drinking something that is really precious. And that there isn't a lot of it, and that it's an amazing, it's just such a cool thing to do, to be a part of, to enjoy it, and to know about. And so if you're one of the 12 listeners who loves this cider and this drink as much as we do, that you're listening to this podcast, then I commend you for having discovered it and for having such passion for what is a wonderful natural product.
Yeah, here. Mm-hmm. And also ought to all of the 12 share a bottle of your favorite bittersweet with one extra person, and then those numbers will double.
Absolutely,
because they're gonna love it.
Yeah, and for my plug, I'm gonna be once again my usual Ross Schilling self, and check out the Ross Cider Crew. It's a really cool little thing. It's a subscription. Where you can choose either monthly, tri-monthly, or what is it, hexa-monthly, I don't know, every 6 months, to receive a number of 500 or 750ml bottles selected by Ross on Y, and that gets delivered, and then you have a kind of selection of interesting and delicious things to drink. I've jumped in, as I said, on the 500ml range, because I feel like my cider education has been somewhat lacking recently, and whilst also branching out into a variety of other makers, I want to get to know single varieties better, and this is an extremely good way to do that. So check that out. You can find that on Ross's website. Hopefully many others will join me in the cider crew. Other than that, any more?
Nope. Just I suppose if we have any European listeners who are going to be attending Cider World next week, then come and say hello, because I'll be there in Frankfurt, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast, just as we did when we went to CiderCon in America, because that was really exciting, and it was great to get to know some people and put some faces to some names. So yeah, come and say hi.
Yeah, absolutely. Do come and say hi. You can find us on social media and emails. Not going to repeat those now, but you can find them in our Instagram and our Twitter and all that kind of thing. Please do get in touch. Any questions, ideas for segments as well. If you're like, I want to hear you guys talk about this, you know, let us know. Get in touch and we will happily engage. I think that's everything. Well then, thank you for listening, and we hope you'd enjoyed the episode. We've had a great time doing it, and we will see you when we see you. Bye-bye.